I'd be happy to take any questions. Yeah.
I was surprised in your public policy considerations, you didn't mention immigration and war.
Yeah.
That certainly is what the United States points to, is why its birth dearth is not as extreme and it's buffered.
Absolutely.
And especially in the light of, you know, concerns about AIDS, especially transmitting diseases, talking about, you know, lowering birth control or not advocating it, you know, carries its own cost when just importing people might be a more straightforward solution.
Yeah. And of course, that's what Canada has relied on for a number of years, unofficially or officially, as a way to offset the falling birth rate, immigration. However, the latest information suggests that the average age now of immigrants that are coming to the country is around about 40 years old. So they're not coming when they're 21 so that they can be productive tax-paying citizens for the next 40 years. They're coming middle age, and of course, we now know that there are a lot of immigrants who come to the country who can't find jobs and who are working driving taxis or flipping Big Macs and this kind of thing. And then, of course, is the issue, growing issue in the 21st century, of national security in terms of the issue of immigration. And there's been a lot of debate recently, of course, about how to assimilate immigrants and the virtues of multiculturalism and so on. So I think I'm speculating here, but I think what we're going to see is that less stock is going to be placed in immigration as a solution to this problem. And I think you're starting to see it in the United States with the rise of the so-called paleoconservative movement and its leadership with Pat Buchanan as its spokesman, and they're advocating strict immigration control. So I'm not sure that immigration is any longer that bipartisan solution to the issue. But of course, that's one of the measures, one of the policies that's been used for decades to offset this problem. Yeah.
You know, I was the other one I was surprised not to hear about was the environment and the impact of the environment in your analysis mm-hmm. as well. Because I don't want to have the session where we're blaming sort of 17th century Frenchmen, but of course, you know, the father of demography, you know, who talked about demography as destiny. I mean, I think that's probably a pretty accurate reflection. But the fact of the matter is the 20th century, we went in a population swing from 1.6 billion people occupying the earth to, you know, at the end of the 20th century, 6.1 billion people. So it was an enormous swing in a 100-year period. And I guess my question to you really becomes one in terms of that enormous swing and now what we're seeing in terms of the tremendous environmental impacts in terms of global warming that you've just mentioned, that a need for some real care and caution around, you know, what is the sort of the impact, the footprint mm-hmm. of human beings and our consumptive needs and requirements, you know, is something that we have to really kind of take into account here in terms of our environmental impact and indeed whether we'll have a globe that is fit to support that population, which by the way I guess goes to 2050, and 2050 goes to 9 billion, that's where the curve levels off. And just to correct the point, there is no birth dearth as I understand it in the United States. In fact, it is a continuing increase in the birth rate there.
Yeah, and I'd actually like to get back to that particular point, but I want to answer your question about the debate about population throughout the 20th century. Now, of course, when people like Paul Ehrlich back in the 1960s were predicting a population bomb, they were, of course, relying on very hard data that fertility rates were rising, and of course medical progress was increasing life expectancy, especially in the developed world. And those numbers did look terrifying. But the thing that Ehrlich, the reason I think that the birth dearth is a more legitimate concern than, say, the population bomb issue was that back in Ehrlich's time, it was very difficult to determine what was an optimum population. For example, you could say, well, Canada would be crowded with, say, 400 million or maybe 500 million people, but could we take more, could we take less? I mean, what, nobody really knew. All we had were numbers. Whereas I think the social science behind the birth dearth does tell us more precisely what this depopulation is going to cost us in terms of our wealth, our prosperity, our affluence. I think the numbers are better. I think the social science is better. And so I think there's more reason to be alarmed. Now, I didn't want to suggest that people like Ehrlich and the population control people who had the stage back in the 1960s and 70s, I don't want to suggest that they were crazy. They weren't crazy. They, as you say, they were basing their research on what they perceived to be significant demographic trends. I'm just saying that they were, if we were going to accuse either side of alarmism, I would accuse the population controllers of alarmism, whereas I would be more hesitant, much more hesitant, obviously, to apply that adjective to the birth dearth people.
You said to make the point, though, that part of the analysis, I mean, part of that analysis has to be the consideration in terms of the environment, technological capacities and impacts.
Yeah. Yeah, and your point is well taken. You can't simply talk about this particular issue without incorporating the environment. I should have paid more attention to it because, of course, population at some point does impact on environmental integrity, and this should be part of the wider debate. And I think that more informed social scientists like Longman and Wattenberg have actually talked about this particular issue. So, but your second point was about this, the...
Yeah, the United States is not in the birth situation.
No. And this is an interesting thing because Philip Longman, who, as I say, is a big D Democrat, has written long and hard about this issue, and he's worried about the birth dearth, or what he calls the empty cradle, because he says, and he's right, that it's mostly religious Americans who are having the big families, whereas I can't remember which is red state and blue state, but the ones that vote Democratic, and the red state, right, their birth rate, the blue states, their birth rates are low, whereas the red states that voted for Bush are fairly high. And of course, he's worried as a card-carrying Democrat that Republicans are outbreeding Democrats, and the important point is the link, the correlation between, according to Longman and other people, religion and family size.
I thought there was a significant racial component there as well in terms of among African Americans and Hispanic Americans, that's where the birth rates were.
The numbers in Hispanic communities are high. I'm not so sure about African American communities. I think their birth rates have pretty much leveled off if they haven't started. I'd like to know, if anyone knows the answer to this, I'd like to know, but I'm suspicious that African-American communities are growing. Sorry.
I was just going to say on the argument for the environmental issue, there are those that would argue that if you have a prosperous society, rather than declining and supporting older people and so on, that you then have a capacity in terms of the development of technology and various other things to take care of the environment.
Yeah.
Towards ahead, cleaning the environment, those types of things. Whereas if you're a society in decline,
you don't have the prosperity to devote money to environmental issues. That's a good point. So I couldn't have answered the question better. That's it. You're next. Sorry.
Oh, is somebody before me?
No.
Okay. Just two points of what I thought were a couple of dissonances that perhaps you could comment on. One, you mentioned that statistically, when surveys are done, Canadians and others say that they, above average, they support ideal family of three or something. But then you list as the reasons why birth rates are plunging are a whole bunch of things: abortion, rising divorce rates, shift from countryside, and rising in literacy and education, late marriage, that reflect personal choice. And so my, perhaps it's cynical, but I look at that and say, well, presumably those people who are giving the statistics of ideal family are saying that's an ideal family, but not for me. And I'm wondering how much of that quote-unquote self-centeredness and self-preservationist mentality is out there, and whether the answers people give in to surveys really reflect their genuine position. And then the second thing I have is that all your solutions, I don't see any relation between your solutions and your reasons why rates are plunging, because all the reasons you gave why birth rates are plunging reflect personal choice, and yet the solutions seem to assume that the real reason or the primary reason why the rates are plunging is because of financial reasons, and yet that really isn't here. So I'm wondering if you can connect the circle on that and maybe address both of those two points.
Well, I thought when I talked about the kind of tax reforms just a minute ago, what I thought was I was doing what essentially Paul mentioned, was to revisit this issue of tax arrangements, and that, of course, increases personal choice. When I was talking about the climate, the environment that's been in existence for decades, that is, I'll call it antinatalist, just to oversimplify. When I talked about that, I was again, I meant to mention this, I was referring back to Paul's comments about the necessity to transform the contemporary culture, which again has been, has emphasized population reduction, has emphasized careers before kids, conspicuous consumption before children, before family, and this sort of thing. So that's what I'm trying to get. Now, your first point was, you had another point.
Yeah, the people saying statistics, what an ideal family.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Their personal choice doesn't seem to bear that.
Well, what kind of a personal choice does a Newfoundlander who lives in an outport and he can't make a living anymore from fishing, how much choice is involved when he has to move to, say, Toronto or Calgary to get a job and leave his home where he wants to stay? I mean, yes, it reflects the fact that people are, in a sense, voting with their feet, but how much choice is actually involved in that? I don't know. It seems to me that they're working under financial incentives, under a system of financial incentives. And that's all I'm talking about when I talk about my solutions. I'm just talking about providing options, providing financial incentives to rectify this particular issue. So that's how I would answer your question. Yeah.
I'd like to come back to the environmental argument and the zero growth. The MIT study 30 years ago, and I remember talking to an economist about that study, and he said, major flaw in that study, they forgot one variable. They forgot that with scarcity, prices go up, and when prices go up, it stimulates supply. Mm-hmm. And if we had followed through on the argument then, we'd be in a crisis situation right now. We would have run out of at least a couple of minerals. I forget which one. I think nickel was one of them. I don't know what the other one was. The other point is that those who are claiming that, you know, we're having too many people forget that people are assets, not liabilities. Mm-hmm. And the more people there are, the more ideas there are.
Yeah.
And in today's high communications environment, the more people have ideas, those ideas have more impact.
Yeah.
Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. One man, one invention. We're all benefiting from it. And everybody, you know, since the invention of the light bulb until the future, will benefit from that. Those effects are cumulative. And I'm going to finish with a question. We're talking about the birth dearth, and based on what we see, it is worrisome. Isn't there the risk that we might be forgetting some variables that might have a compensating effect, which will mitigate some of the negative consequences in the same way that the MIT group forgot about supply and demand 30 years ago?
Such as?
I did just do.
Yeah.
Why don't you just cut Social Security? You know, if you go to a traditional society and you ask them, why do you want children? They often say to take care of me in my old age.
Mm-hmm.
When that function is being served other ways,
yeah,
then the quote need and the motivation for children may change. So, I mean, and again, that's interesting, a variable in the equation. The other one is sort of what happens when the flu epidemic hits. And for all the, you know, anxieties about, you know, an aging population, I wonder what a risk analysis says of what the probability of a worldwide flu epidemic. There are some who say it's fundamentally inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
there's strong reason to believe that that's going to disproportionately adversely affect the old.
The elders.
Rather than the young, although yeah. some suggestion that actually under 25 may not have enough immunity to name yeah. something too. So I just throw these into the yeah. equation where we look back 30 years on Ehrlich and say, nice job and you missed the target. Mm-hmm. I wonder here if we could end up, you know,
yeah. Well, I mean, as far as cutting Social Security, you're talking about the kind of reforms that maybe some of us in this room would, under our breath, say, yes, you know, that's the kind of thing that could be done. But we're talking also about reforms that are politically possible in this day and age. And this is why, this is the context I wanted to provide, that was the context within which I was putting forward these policy recommendations. I was thinking of things which would have more or less bipartisan support that would unite politicians, parliamentarians, opinion makers, think tank folks from one end of the spectrum to the other. And I mean, yeah, we can think of a lot of radical changes that can be done. And again, what I hear from the audience is that that we should act cautiously on this issue because who knows, it may turn out to be not that grave an issue. I'm suspicious of that. But if that's true, then yes, we should proceed, I think, cautiously with modest policy reforms that don't alienate large sectors of the electorate and don't scuttle political chances of actually taking some important steps, I think, towards creating a family-friendly environment here in this country. So, I'm sure cutting Social Security would have the effect that you propose. Again, whether it's possible in this day and age, certainly in Ottawa in the year 2006, I don't think so. Sorry, there's a question at the back.
Do you think recognizing stay-at-home parents, unpaid labor, if you will, could factor into raising the birth rate?
Recognizing in what way?
Recognizing them economically. As a, you know, we are a benefit to your economic society, but mm-hmm. right now we're not recognized in that way at all.
It's possible. Again, I'm not a social scientist, so I'm not exactly sure what the impact of that would be. It seems to me that by rewarding somebody who stays, a spouse who stays at home with their children, rewarding them monetarily, I think would probably be beneficial. But I think, again, that there might be some political opposition to that kind of thing, especially if it's rewarding labor. What's the word I'm thinking of? Extravagantly, unpaid labor extravagantly. So I'm not sure about the politics of that, but it's possible. It's possible it would have a stimulating effect.
Thank you.
I was wondering, all that we've been saying here has already been recognized by a number of governments, the EU, even Canada, Statistics Canada has talked about it, but it's not really visible in popular culture. I mean, popular culture and the people you've cited like Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, you know, Ted Turner, and a lot of these organizations, these NGOs, are still pushing for family planning.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're saying here just seems so countercultural, and I'm wondering if popular culture would even be able to change to change its message and to mm-hmm. see families and childbearing and child rearing as positive.
Yeah.
And do you think that will happen? Do you already see that happening in any way? Do you see any social liberals coming out in, you know, in favor of larger families?
Well, Philip Longman, for one, yeah, mm-hmm. who's, as I said, is a major small L liberal in the United States, which I think is a significant sign. And he finds newspapers like the Washington Post and the New York Times to publish his articles in, so obviously there must be some editorial support for his positions. And the criticisms of the polls that have been aired notwithstanding, I think that they're interesting. I think they are significant because they do tell us that, I think they tell us that Canadians do prefer bigger families. In other words, that this is the populist sentiment out there. And that populist sentiment, and I'm the first one to agree with you, has been buried to a certain extent by the very influential, let's face it, wealthy folks who can command the media on this particular issue, like Bill Gates, like Warren Buffett. And so the message that the kinds of things that you're talking about do get overlooked, do get overshadowed, but it's not because people don't out there believe it. I think they do. I think there's a lot of sentiment generally in favor, and that's why I put credence in these kind of poll numbers, because I think they suggest that, again, there's a disjoint between official policy, official culture on the one hand, and popular sentiment on the other. And I see this, again, historians are often accused of being great at predicting the past. So I'm not going to, I feel very leery about predicting the future, but if this is the beginning of a trend, then this trend, if it continues in the 21st century, I think will do a lot to address this issue of the birth dearth. And of course, this is one of the things I'm trying to point out. It's that this issue has incredible global momentum and traction right now. And it's only a matter of time before we as Canadians have to acknowledge it and take it seriously. The kinds of comments I've heard this morning are very good because at least we're debating the issue. At least we're talking about it. And that, I think, is very, very important, because even if the pro-family people lose the debate in the long run, they've had a public platform for a while to air their own views. And I think that that's all to the good.
There's been a lot of efforts on the part of especially women's groups, Status of Women in Canada, for example, to downplay the role of fathers as breadwinners. We're an egalitarian society, and they want the women to earn as much money as the men, and that's where the taxation system, how it's developed. Now, historically, isn't this unprecedented? Haven't societies always recognized the importance of the father as breadwinner and the mother in the family as primarily caring for the children?
Mm-hmm.
Is this brand new in society?
Yes, I think it is revolutionary. I think it is revolutionary. Of course, if you go back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, you'll find that what constituted the family there isn't exactly what we think of as the nuclear family today, with a house in suburbia and two cars in the driveway and so on. But I think the basic biological fact of the family is something that's been recognized for centuries and centuries and centuries. This isn't my area of expertise. I'm not actually a historian of the family and marriage. But from what I've read from other historians, from other scholars who have looked at the subject, I think that that's quite true. Sure, do you have time?
I have a point that I think there is some notion of privilege to being able to be, say, a mother with a breadwinner earning an income, and certainly lower income, and if I'm not have that privilege, enough long lived outside the home, and not too long ago, the economy was more home-based and farm-based anyway. The idea that one person saved from the other one and earned income was, I think, coming later. So,
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I suppose the notion of separate spheres is a fairly recent development in history. Although you can date it back to the 19th century, separate spheres. But you're right, that clear delineation, that clear distinction between jobs for women and jobs for men, I think historically, from an historical perspective, was a creation of the post-war period. But I wasn't talking about that necessarily. I'm just talking about the basic biological functions of fathers and mothers. Yeah.
I actually have two questions. The first is perhaps a quick one. Japan had a 10-year recession, and it's been described by some as the first recession that was caused by the birth dearth. So I'm curious to know if you agree with that. And the second question is it faith or is it economics and tax policy? I thought you were arguing that it was a question of taxation. Then you mentioned the U.S. saying red state, blue state,
yeah,
which if it's a question of faith, then I think Europe is doomed, and perhaps Canada is a question of economics,
yeah,
and tax policy. There is perhaps hope for these Western countries.
Yeah, again, I'm referring back to the context in which I made these policy suggestions, and that context is one based on what is politically possible. So, I mean, if we get up on public platforms and say, you've all got to convert, become devout Christians to solve the birth dearth, that's not going to go anywhere. But the correlation between religion and family size still holds. What I'm talking about are these kinds of, again, modest policy issues that I think that we can actually achieve in this in the foreseeable future, and which will be a start towards generating more and more respect for the kinds of things we've done. And your first question was about Japan and its recession. I'm not aware of the link between the recession in Japan and the loss in fertility in Japan. And I suppose what you're suggesting is that when there's an economic depression, birth rates fall.
No, actually, that was in fact the falling birth rate led to the recession because there were fewer replacement workers. And I think it's hard to explain why Japan was in a 10-year recession. And I'm wondering if in fact it was the lack of workers to fill the jobs of those who were retired.
That could be. I just don't know. And I'd be speaking from ignorance if I tried to answer that question. But
two more questions.
Okay. Why don't you field them, Andrew? Because I'm bad at this sort of thing.
A couple more. We'll take one here, and then we'll take two.
Just a quick observation on the tax issue. In New Zealand, we are above replacement rate. We're 2.1. Sorry. Just a quick observation on tax and so forth. In New Zealand, we're above replacement rate, 2.1. But the government was still worried about this very issue. And they introduced something called Working for Families Package. And that was a sort of subsidy. So if you're getting $50,000 per annum, you got $3,000 for children. But what they found, or what research seems to be suggesting, is that this incentivized the men and the women in their workplace. And so we have evidence that there are guys there saying, well, I won't go after that promotion, because when I've done the calculations on the tax, I'm no better off. I'm better sick to take the 3,000 for the children, and that will be good. Mm. So I think if you're looking at tax reform here, you need to do it in the sense of what tax incentives can you give to the men and the women involved, rather than giving them a supplementary benefit.
Yeah.
I have more of a comment than anything else. I think the challenge is really to how we strike a balance between enabling people to have families and without adopting a pronatalist policy that limits women's choices, mm-hmm. or gives them or society the message that a woman's only function or even primary function is in having children. I run a small charity that's an infertility support organization that seeks to provide information and support to people so they can make informed choices about their options. We're neither pro nor anti-technology. We have a lot of concerns about what's going on in the field. And one of the biggest factors that's affecting, you know, younger people is the fact that is delayed childbearing. And the fact that women in particular only have about 10 years in a window of time between when they graduate from university and when their fertility starts to decline markedly by mid-30s. And in that time, there's a huge pressure on them to establish their careers, find a suitable life partner, have children, and it's not easy having. So when a lot of the women who end up in fertility treatment is because they're older, because they've waited too long, and there's a bunch of factors leading to that. First of all, they're not getting the education that they need in high school. Most high school health education is focused on, besides health, obviously contraception, because nobody wants to see teens being pregnant. So young people at a critical point in their life, when they're being encouraged to plan their future, are not being given information about how their fertility is going to start to decline. So they're not really being able to think ahead in that regard.
Yep.
And then when they are working, I mean, what they say is, you know, it was hard to meet somebody that I wanted to be with. Or, you know, I wanted to have children earlier, but Like, there's no childcare available. I don't know how to do all this. You know, it's so expensive to live. So I think we need a whole bunch of changes in our society that make it easier for people to have children. And when somebody does stay home in a family, when you do have that single income family, they're paying a price not only in the short term that you pointed out for the taxing. The person who stays at home is paying a price in the long term in terms of corporate pensions, in terms of Canada pension. So there's a whole bunch of changes that need to happen to make it easier. And then along with that is all the hype in the media about the celebs who have babies late in life and the reprotect industry telling people, you know, we're here, we can take care of you, you can have children later. So all these things lead people to delay childbearing. And I think that feeds into part of the birth dearth that you're talking about.
Yeah, and I think an excellent area to do some work in is the field of education. If they could integrate what do they call them now? It's not sex ed, it's biology courses or whatever they call them now. If you could integrate these kinds of issues that you've talked about so that it's not simply contraception, it's not simply preventing teen pregnancy, which I think are laudable goals, but if it integrates these other factors, which are going to affect these young people as they get older, I think that too is gives them a more balanced outlook as they emerge as adults. So I think that's important, and I also think that we ought to be looking, and I haven't looked at this very closely yet, but we ought to be looking at countries like Sweden and Denmark, which are experimenting with a mix of these kinds of reforms, which enable women, of course, to pursue careers at the same time as enjoy motherhood, and I think that that watching these particular countries and their experiences, their experiments, I think will have a lot to tell us.